We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hello, everybody. My name's Sean. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 3rd, 1981. My home group is 435 Compton Intergroup in the lovely city of Compton, California. And I do have a sponsor, John F. And I sponsor several gentlemen and a couple of ladies. What it was like, what happened, what's like now. I got sober at 16. Beautiful gift, freedom from the bondage of alcohol at a very young age. I got sober at a place called Indian Charlie's in Artesia, California. I had the gift of getting sober with lots of old timers, people who had been around Alcoholics Anonymous since the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. And there wasn't a lot of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1981. Myself, and there was another young lady. But for the most part, well, when you're 16, everybody looks old. But there's a lot of middle-aged people and old people. Especially nobody that looked like me. I had green hair, leather jacket, boots up to my knees, and was welcomed to Alcoholics Anonymous. Back then, signalness of purpose was strictly adhered to. I also used outside issues. You really weren't allowed to talk about any of that in AA in the early 80s. My home group today still adheres to that, singleness of purpose. I respect the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I also use many outside issues. I believe they got me to AA sooner than later. Those old timers, I'm really grateful to them. I'm grateful to my first sponsor, a man named Johnny E. He told me the truth about my condition. And he seemed to know exactly how to handle a person of my type. And when I say my type, what I mean is somebody who is rebellious, irreverent, hostile, violent, disrespectful. I came to you fine folk hating God. And I'll go a little bit into that just for some context. Raised Catholic, Catholic school. I had some experiences there that have really impacted my life for a significant portion of my life. Some of it I didn't know for many, many years. I had a gap in my memory in the fourth grade. Did not come to understanding why or what had happened until later on in life. Some things were done to me as a child that no child should have to experience, no human being should have to experience at the hands of someone who claimed to represent God. And my mind blanked it out for me. I believe today, and I don't have any proof of it, other than it's what I believe, that God gave me what I could handle. Because of this program and my relationships that I was able to repair, or that were repaired in the 12-step process in my life, specifically my mother. I remember having a conversation with her because I couldn't remember, and I don't know why it was coming up, other than the fact that it was coming up, some kind of thing that was kind of just pulling at me, nagging at me. And I started talking to my mom about it and asking her questions about that period of time. And she became visibly upset, very uncomfortable. And she started to get emotional. And I wasn't quite understanding why. And then she made the statement. She said, I knew that this would eventually come up. And we had a long discussion. Found out that some of my schoolmates, a couple of young girls, my mom volunteered at the school. They had approached my mother and told her that I was being abused by this particular nun. I had never said anything to my parents about it. My mother and father, they went to the school and they talked with the principal, who was also a nun, and the nun who was my teacher. And, you know, you got to realize this was back in the 70s, and the church, whatever they said was, that's what was the law. People didn't really question the church's authority then. They basically said what you would think, you know, vivid children's imaginations. None of that happened. You know, Sean's a precocious child, and maybe some of the discipline may have been a little bit much at times, and that would be addressed, but none of this other stuff took place. And I was sent back to the back to my abuser. I was abused, you know, mentally, physically, emotionally, somewhat sexually. And all this was a gap in my memory for many, many years. I tell this story in detail, and I hope no one finds that offensive, but it is a big part of my story. I believe it is why I turned from God at such a young age and had such a problem with the aspect of personal relationship with a higher power for so many years in Alcoholics Anonymous. To follow up on that story of the conversation with my mother, because I had had a significant amount of recovery and work in the steps and some healing, I not only was able to get some clarity and some down to causes and conditions, but I was able to give my mother the opportunity to free herself of that, to get free of it, to heal together. She had taken on quite a bit of shame and guilt for many years, carrying that, feeling somewhat responsible for the trajectory of my life. I think most of it in her subconscious, but it was always there. There was also a divide between her and I that developed in my life. And I believe that it all could be traced back to that. So we were able to talk and cry and hug my mother, and she felt a sense of freedom, and I'm really grateful to that. So back to the hating God, I say I got free from the bondage of alcohol at 16. I did not get freedom from the bondage itself until I was 51 years old. That's a whole lot of one day at a time and a whole lot of suffering. Those old timers, my sponsor, the members of my home group that carried the message to me, they knew how to handle somebody like me. And they told me, don't worry about any of that stuff about God. You can use AA as your higher power. Here's a group of drunks staying sober together. You can't stay sober on your own. You've conceded to your innermost self that you're powerless over alcohol. We can do together what you can't do alone. Can you believe in that, Sean? I could wrap my head around that. And that was a sufficient start for me. I would read the big book and I would start seething. They would talk about God and God and God. And I knew what those old timers told me, that it's your own conception of God. But I knew that they were trying to trick me. You know, that was the hook. Oh, yeah, your own conception of God. But once we got you, then you're going to believe in the God that we want you to believe in. You know, some more of that dogma that I had grown up with in Catholic school. But those old timers always told me the truth. What they said then was true then, and it's still true today. You know, my own conception of God, my own personal relationship with God. but that worked for me. And I know today now that what was really happening is I was being spoon-fed the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that was palatable to me, that I could wrap my head around. I was being given direction in these spiritual principles. I was asked to take these contrary actions, contrary to what my thinking and my emotions would tell me. Are you willing to do it? And I was willing to do it, sometimes begrudgingly, but I always followed that direction from my first sponsor. And I was getting results. I was growing. I wouldn't have called it growing spiritually then, but I was growing. And I was adhering to the principles. You know, I was living differently. I was still rebellious. I was still defiant. I was still very angry and violent. You know, I got to AA, as I said, very young. I was very involved in the punk rock music scene and in the early 80s in Los Angeles. And after that first year of going to meetings and staying sober, I got involved back in the music scene. And I would be at punk rock shows, getting in fights, hanging out with my friends. That was my social scene. Then I'd go to meetings. I'd come with black eyes, busted mouth, bruises all over me. And it was really a release for me. So I had so much energy and so much anger. And I could go to these shows and dance and fight. It was a way for me to let go. I really enjoyed those days. I had a lot of friends, and none of them were in AA. And what's so interesting is that sometimes they seem to be more protective of my sobriety than I was. You know, anytime we would be anywhere and anybody would push a drink towards me or ask me if I wanted a drink, my friends seemed to always be, I wouldn't even have to say anything. They'd say, hey, he doesn't drink. And if anybody was adamant about it, there could be a ruckus. And my friends would be right there defending, hey, he doesn't drink. And I always appreciated that. I haven't thought of any of that stuff in a while. So like I said, man, that first 8 years of my recovery, going to Indian Charlie's, Johnny E is my sponsor. All those old timers that my great grand sponsor, my grand sponsor, so many other people who told me the truth about my condition. They say, get in the car. You know, we're going to a meeting. You know, then after the meeting, hey, we're going to go to Denny's, get something to eat. Well, I didn't have a job. I didn't have any money. They said, we didn't ask you if you had any money. You hungry? Yeah, get in the car. That truth about my condition, you know, they weren't always nice about it. One of my sobriety brothers, we had the same sponsor. I wasn't working, didn't want to work. I was living at home. He came to pick me up to go to the meeting. I was kind of in a bad mood, and he asked me what was wrong. And I told him that my parents actually had told me I needed to get a job. And I couldn't believe it. I'm working really hard to stay sober, and they want me to go work. And he looked at me. He didn't say anything. And he pulled up in front of this liquor store that was by my parents' house, and he asked me what I wanted to drink. I looked at him and said, I don't want anything to drink. He says, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go in there and get you what you want. And I'm going to come out. I'm going to take you back to the house. And you're going to go in there. You're going to grab all your stuff and put in some trash bags. And then I'm going to take you down to the park, and you can live at the park since you don't want to get a job and you don't want to follow the rules. Well, it hurt my feelings. I got very upset and indignant. I said, no, let's just go to the meeting. You know, and he basically told me, you've been using those people, abusing those people your whole life. You're lazy and you don't follow directions. They want you to get a job, so get a job or get out. I started looking for a job. He couldn't wait to tell my sponsor what had happened when we got to the meeting. They all had a good laugh at my expense. It was like that in those days. Still is. I love the gallows humor of Alcoholics Anonymous. we laugh about these things, and people who may not be of what we are and the experiences that we've had, they might be shocked and abhorred by it. But really, why shouldn't we laugh? You know, we're living a new life. We've been given a chance. We've been given a way out of that insanity, that suffering. So like I said, that first 8 years of my recovery was, I call it being in the loving arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really loved my sponsor. He was the first man besides my father that I respected. And my respect for my father was mostly out of fear. But Johnny, I respected him because of his intelligence, because of his charm, because of the way he carried himself. He had everything I wanted. And I know today, even though he had told me, don't put me on a pedestal, you know, I'm not your higher power, I had made him my higher power, him and my home group. And that came back to be something that I would have to face and let go of. And that also took quite a while. So when I was 8 years sober, Johnny died. And it really threw me for a loop. I didn't handle it very well. It really destroyed me. I didn't drink, but something inside of me wasn't the same. And things were going on at my home group. People, some of the old timers, because they were, you know, older and retired, were moving away. They weren't at the meeting. The meetings weren't the same. There was some political infighting, and the group started to fracture and splinter. And I left. I thought, well, I'll just go to some other meetings, and tried to do that. And it didn't work so well for me. I went to these other meetings, and they talked a lot about God. They talked a lot about things that I wasn't interested in, didn't believe in, still made me angry, and I didn't know what to do. I couldn't go back to my home group because I didn't feel comfortable there. I was resentful. I was hurt. I know today through inventory that I blame Johnny for how I felt and how I thought. I was angry at him for dying. I couldn't go back. And I couldn't go to these other meetings because all they talked about was God. They just seemed to be goody two-shoe people. So I stopped going to meetings. I didn't drink. I left Alcoholics Anonymous that time for 2.5 years. Went completely crazy, insane. Almost drank. I was sitting in a salon, a friend of mine, getting my hair bleached. And there was an old timer there, Johnny H., who I'd known since early recovery. I was having a conversation with Johnny and telling Johnny about, man, I just don't go to those meetings anymore. I just sick and tired of sitting around, listening to people talk about their problems and always talking about their problems and talking about themselves. I got a life to live, man. I got to get out there and buy a house and have a family and, you know, make my money. And I don't have time for that. It's staying sick. And I remember, like it happened yesterday, the look in Johnny's eye and the shake of his head. And as he was walking out the door, he just said, good luck, kid. You know, and I remember it so well because it was probably another 10, 12 years later, another old timer, Richard F., running to him in the Ralphs. This time I'd been away from AA again, about 4 or 5 years, having the same basic conversation. And he had the same look in his eye that Johnny had. He had the same shake of his head. And he said the same damn thing. Good luck, kid. As he walked away, you know. So I made it back to AA that first time and got real active back in going to meetings. By this time, I'd had been married and my marriage was failing. And I met a girl in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she started drinking again, and all of the insanity that comes with a relationship with one person drinking and the other person suffering from untreated alcoholism. And in the material world, all that kind of stuff starts to fall apart. Her losing her job, the bills start piling up, the lies start happening, the stealing, all the things that happen in a marriage that is falling apart because of alcoholism, or maybe just a marriage falling apart. People who aren't alcoholics have the same kind of issues that we tend to have. That all ended up making me come back to AA, getting back involved in AA. I went to a place in Long Beach where I live called the Round Table. It's a unique place. You know, they really focus on physical sobriety. They focus on step one. I always call it a den of thieves and a pack of wolves. And I fit right in. They focus on step one. I ain't drinking today. Nothing else matters except I ain't drinking. Don't drink. Go to a lot of meetings and talk to other drunks. I wouldn't be sober today if it wasn't for the Round Table. I fit right in there. Crazy, insane, not drinking, but not living by spiritual principles. Don't have a sponsor anymore. I didn't get another sponsor after Johnny. I had one for the first 8 years. It was another 18 years before I got another sponsor. So I spent 18 years out in the wilderness, sponsored by a fool myself. And I paid the price. You know, I guess the story that I'm really trying to tell, I'm trying to lead up to what brought me to this place of insanity from 8 years sober to who I am today and what I went through, what I didn't drink through, what I suffered from. I'm really trying to carry the message that I believe I have of step one of my life being unmanageable, having to hit a bottom, having to hit a deep bottom. I had that bottom in relation to alcohol very young. But it was 28 years sober before I had a deeper experience in step one and realized that all my human resources had failed me, that I'd been crushed, you know, that bone-crushing juggernaut of self, that there was only King Alcohol or God. What's my choice going to be? God either is or he isn't. Untreated alcoholism, spiritual malady, self-reliance, you know, those all mean the same thing. You know, the literature asked me, can I pass the acid test? And my story is an affirmative no. I've had a lot of material world success, owning homes, vacation homes, stock portfolios, a significant six-figure career, another marriage, lots of travel, lots of events, and lots of people all the time dying of untreated alcoholism. Every time trying to get to this place of being satisfied, of being okay. I love what the book says. Suffer from the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of the world if I just managed well. And I just kept trying to do that over and over and over. And I would always end up in the same place. And I could never figure out how did I get here again? How did this happen again? You know, I could never figure it out. I could never see the common denominator. It was always somebody else's fault. About the best I could do was admit that as far as getting in relationships, my picker was broken. Because it was always her fault, their fault, the job's fault, that boss, that coworker, that neighbor, somebody else's fault. If I had any part in it, it was justified and rationalized my behavior, my actions. And I wouldn't have done that if you hadn't have done this. My reaction was justified. Everybody knows that this is how it should be. I shouldn't even have to tell you. But because you can't seem to get with it, you know, I have to do this. Oh, my God. You know, I look back on my life and I have so much compassion for myself in these different phases. You know, that teenager that was so wounded that got this opportunity, that found Alcoholics Anonymous at such a young age, but was so, so wounded. And then that young man who was so defiant and restless and irritable and discontent and still had all those wounds. Middle-aged man who continued the defiance, continued, you know, shaking his fist at God and the world, you know, and I'm going to conquer this. I'm going to make it. I am going to succeed. I am right. Finally what it took for me. So I had a second failed marriage. In that marriage, I'd made it back to Alcoholics Anonymous. At 22 years sober, I was in a bad, bad state. I'd been away from AA for a while the second time. I'd get off work. I was working a lot of graveyard shifts. I would get off at 5 in the morning, and I'd drive down Ocean Boulevard, and there was this AM/PM, and I'd stop there, and I'd get a pint of chocolate Haagen-Dazs ice cream and whatever else. And I'd go back to my apartment. I no longer own a home. Now I live in a little apartment. I'd sit there, I'd take a shower, and I'd sit there and I'd watch Apocalypse Now at 5 in the morning, smoking Cuban cigars, eating ice cream, and wondering, really in just self-pity, you know, just the victim. Why am I even sober? Look at my life. Look what's happened to my life. Why am I even bothering with any of this? You know, had some moments of suicidal, you know, fantasies, but not really seriously. You know, I'm not one that has spent a lot of time thinking about killing myself. See, before that, and it really scared me, because before that I'd always been, and it was foundational for me, that nobody can take my sobriety, and that the only way I'm going to lose my sobriety is if I pour booze down my throat. And it had always been like a badge of honor, you know, my physical sobriety. And now it had no real meaning to me. It was beginning to lose its significance. It wasn't a badge of honor. It was just something standing in the way of, you know, wherever I was headed. And that scared me. I did what I had always done before that. I ran to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I crossed that threshold. I'm sure many of you have felt this, that sigh of relief. Like, whew, man. I'm home. I'm okay. AA's got me. But something was different. And I was really, really scared. See, I knew if I left AA again, I would drink. I knew that. And what really had me afraid was I always leave. There comes a point where I get resentful. I can't, I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. Going to a bunch of meetings isn't doing it for me. Something's got to change. And I just wanted to stay in AA. But I just knew that I wasn't going to be able to. See, I wasn't somebody who prayed. Didn't do any praying. But I had this moment where I guess I was just talking to the A collective and just like, please help me. I just don't want to leave. Please let me stay. And I say 20 years later, I haven't had to leave Alcoholics Anonymous in 20 years. I'm so grateful for that. I wouldn't be sober today if I left again. I know that. So I know looking back that what had transpired is I had had a little bit of a surrender and I'd had a little bit of some kind of awakening and that I had developed a little bit of humility. So I kept just trying to do what other people were doing, but I was still really spiritually sick. I was still very selfish and self-centered. I still hated God. I was still defiant. But I was going to a lot of meetings and I was talking to folks and I was just trying to be one among many. And then God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. 4 years later, I'm 26 years sober. My sponsor that I have today walks into the room of the round table, has no business being there, doesn't fit in, sticks out like a sore thumb. He's a kind, gentle, little old man. He wears these shoes that have springs in them, and he carries a butt cushion everywhere he goes because he has problems when he sits. He doesn't use profanity. He doesn't talk loud. And I immediately notice him. He's there because he met somebody from there at another meeting who was looking for something different. And he told John about the round table, and John said, thought he needed a little change in his recovery, so he thought he'd check out a new meeting. And he showed up at the round table, and I noticed him immediately, and I listened to him, and there was something very attractive about him. It was his demeanor. It was the almost like an aura, a sense of peace. I didn't know that's what it was then, but there was something different about him. Of course, I didn't go right up to him right away. You know, my ego won't let me. I think I'm really somebody. So I'm going to check him out, watch him for a while, see if he's worthy of sponsoring me. I listen to him. Some time goes by. I have a conversation. I ask him if he'll work with me. And he agrees. And I'm so grateful for that day. I never say this in front of him because he doesn't like it. That man saved my life. I owe my sobriety that I have today to him. I'm very grateful for that. And it started very, very rudimentary. He didn't have much to work with. And he really started working with trying to get me to consider. Would you consider? He was trying to open my mind to help me become willing to have the channel unblocked. I'd always been a very negative, cynical, sarcastic person. I didn't avoid collisions. I looked for them. I liked collisions with people. I liked arguing. I loved winning an argument. I loved making people uncomfortable. I liked it when people were intimidated by me or afraid of me or didn't want to be around me. That was all very okay with me. You get me to consider that there was something wrong with my way of thinking. And, you know, my ego, I got a lot of ego. I got a lot of pride. I'm 26 years sober. Got a really good job. I got a lot going for me. So I think. He didn't want anything I had. And this turning a negative thinking into positive, taking that negative position and what I consider the opposite of it is really how it began. And I started working with that. Very, very simple, very rudimentary. Nothing overly spiritual or no talk of God and being connected to the stillness or sitting in silence. None of that at this point. But things started happening. Within a year, new people that would come in that would get to know me, see something had changed in me. I was having that educational variety. I was in the transformation period of my spiritual awakening. I was experiencing God. I know that today. I didn't know that then. See, I had developed an open mind. John helped me develop an open mind. I was honest. And I was willing. I didn't yet have a belief in the power of God, but my belief in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous had returned, and that was sufficient. And I just kept with it. I'd like to tell you that after those two failed marriages and getting a sponsor, that I saw and was taught and shown that what really mattered was my relationship with a power greater than myself. And that if I focused on getting right spiritually, that everything would fall into place mentally and physically. But that would be a lie. I fell in love with a newcomer. And the next 2 years, or close to 2 years of my life, I was on a pink cloud. She was beautiful. She was artistic. She was creative. She was brilliant. She made me laugh. She became my higher power. And at 28 years sober, that relationship ended, and it destroyed me. I couldn't let go, and I almost drank. It was so overwhelming. It was so defeating. I was so obliterated. I had no moves left. She started dating a friend of mine, a lady friend of mine who was married and was hanging out with us because her marriage was falling apart. And then they ended up getting connected, which I already knew that my girlfriend was bisexual. She left a woman to be with me. And I was so shocked when she left me to be with a woman. That's how crazy we can be. I went to a meeting to sit down with both of them. And I was so delusional that I thought that they were going to make an amends to me. And they were going to let me know that how wrong they had been. And that we were going to take things back to the way they were. And everybody was going to be good. I actually went into that conversation with that expectation. And I left that cafe that we were at completely coming apart at the seams, having an emotional breakdown, out of my mind, hyperventilating. I could barely get in my car. I drove the 2 miles or so to my house that I'm sitting in now. I couldn't get out of the car. And I just started coming apart. I was thirsty. I really needed a drink. I couldn't feel how I was feeling. That deep sense of betrayal, that deep sense of not being enough, that sense of lack that I've had my whole life just came rushing in all on me. And I was drowning. I was drowning in it. You know, I'm crying. I'm hyperventilating. Snot's running out of my nose. I'm these mewing sounds like a wounded animal or coming out of my mouth. I don't know if any of you have seen that movie, The Bad Lieutenant with Harvey Keitel. That's the sounds I was making. And I really needed a drink. But I didn't want to drink. And I came to this place, the second step proposition. God either is or isn't. What's your choice going to be, Sean? And I cried out for help. You know, I cried out for help. I couldn't live the way I was living where I didn't have any moves left. And I always had a move. I always had an exit stage left. I always had a countermeasure. I always had another strategy. I always landed on my feet. And I was just completely destroyed. I was crushed. And the beauty of all of this, I didn't realize it till later, but I was actually able to get up out of that car that I've been in, sitting in for over an hour. And I was able to come in the house. I made a phone call. I called a lady who's known me since I got sober, Betty A. from Escondido. And I'm crying and, you know, coming apart, telling Betty everything that happened. And, you know, Betty's one of them hardcore old AAs. And she told me point blank, she said, I want you to go and get all of her stuff and pack it up, and I want you to put it outside. I'm like, well, I can't do that, Betty. You know, and I'm crying. And she says, she's not your problem anymore. Of course, I didn't follow her direction. It was the most reasonable, sound logic. Things would have been different if I had, but I didn't. What happened was she came home and she wouldn't leave. And I've asked her to leave. She won't leave. And I don't know what to do. I asked God again for help because I can't get her to leave. I'm afraid I'm going to drink or do something horrible. I asked God for help. The next morning, my phone rings. It's a day off for me. My phone rings, and it's my work. And my boss says, we need you to go up north in California and oversee this project. They're having a lot of problems up there, and we need you to go up there and see if you can get that thing back on track. Can you go? And I said, when? And he said, next Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And I said, yes. And I was on a plane to Northern California, and I was up there for 4 months. I couldn't leave. God did for me once again what I couldn't do for myself. And in that time up there, I did some deep, deep work, a lot of inventory, praying on my knees, which I'd never done, except when I was in Catholic school. Hadn't done it since. My sponsor and Betty, you know, bless both of them. I'd be on the phone with them every day. I don't know how they put up with me, you know, all my crying and whining and my self-pity. And I started getting into step 6 and 7 after doing 4 and 5 and looking at myself. I just couldn't let go. I could not let go of her. And I'm trying to control a relationship that's over in Long Beach, 800 miles away from where I'm at, in Benicia, California. And as I said earlier, my sponsor, he doesn't cuss. He don't raise his voice. He's always been very kind and loving. And I made that man step out of character because I was frustrated him so much, where he cussed me out in a loud voice and hung up the phone on me. He told me, he said, God damn it. God's removed her from your life. You won't fucking let go. And click, he hung up. I believe that that was directed from God. This man stepping out of character like that, he might as well slap me in the face. It got my attention. And it just clicked. And I saw the truth of what he was saying. And in that moment, I was able to let go of her. So much has happened in that time. You know, this is a program of, I'm of the educational variety. You know, those violent twists of my personality, unraveling those. It was another 6 years before I came to the realization that I had to give every area of my life to God. I also realized that the rules apply to me. It's something that I'd never even begin to fathom. I thought the rules were for chumps and church folk. See, I found out that lust and greed are two of my biggest defects of character. I thought I knew more about women and money than God. And you go ahead and handle these areas over here, God. I'll take care of this. I'll take care of the women and the money. And I literally almost killed myself. 34 years sober. I had a health crisis. Ended up being the end of my career. And when I say I almost killed myself, I mean literally almost killed myself, not figuratively. Had a 7-year health challenge, chronic hypertension. And that turned into obesity and type 2 diabetes over that period of time. In a year, I went from 220 to 330. Gained 110 pounds in a year, which brought on the type 2 diabetes. Could barely move. Things started changing. All that brought me closer to my higher power. I had to go in deeper. I had to start seeing these things in inventory in the 12 steps that had to be addressed, that had to be let go of. You know, prayer became an important part of my life. I really didn't have any real idea of prayer, the use of it. I didn't have any expectation on where it was going to take me. But I knew my sponsor prayed, people that I respected prayed, great men and women throughout history have used prayer. They believe in it. So why not me? I thought at the very least, it'll give me some perspective, some discipline, and some humility. And God knows I need a bunch of that. I am still awestruck by the power of prayer. Prayer actually has repaired much of my thinking. There's actually scientific evidence. There were some studies run out of UCLA on this, you know, and how it repairs and creates new synapses in our brain. And I found that to be true. My thinking has changed. It's also opened my heart. These conversations with God, I don't much do our traditional prayers, you know, except at meetings, you know, third step prayer, serenity prayer, the Lord's prayer, that type of stuff, seven step prayer. I just talk to God, whatever that may be to you. God is experiential, I believe. I can't define God or understand God, and I don't need to. But I've experienced God and I know God. You know, it's one of the things that people in general, and you know, especially alcoholics, struggle with is this need to know. Got to know the end result. What's in it for me? How's it going to look? How am I going to feel? What are people going to think? Where am I going to end up? All of that. We can't take that leap of faith. And that's what I had to do. And my sponsor helped me get close enough to the shore, but he couldn't get me onto the shore of faith. I had to take that leap without any thought of how it's going to end up. I couldn't live the way I was living anymore. That's a daily experience for me. Steps 1, 2, and 3. I can't, God can, I'm going to let him. It's a different experience in step 1. It's a different experience in step 2 and step 3. I no longer have to be bludgeoned and beaten into humility. I don't have to experience that bottom, literally. I don't have to bottom out for every time that I'm obedient, for every time that I surrender. I can surrender daily because I desire to be in right relation to God and with all of you. I don't have to be beaten into that. So my first step experience is now a beautiful experience of being powerless. I'm no longer afraid of it. And since I have had that experience, the understanding of the solution, that God is the solution, a power greater than me is the solution, I lean into that willingly. And I make that decision every day, the death of self, you know, to turn my will and my life over to God. God, you take it. You direct me. You inspire me. You give me the courage. God, please direct my thinking today. It's become almost automatic. It's a beautiful thing. And I know some of you may not believe me, and I understand. You know, and if you stay with it, if you stick with the saw, as we say at Compton, no matter how dull the blade gets, it'll cut. You will get there. It used to be very mechanical for me. I thought, man, I'm not going to be able to do this. And I didn't even know how true that statement was. Self can't remove self. I got to have God's help. You know, these paradoxes that AA has helped me to accept and to embrace and to not question. I got to put everything I got into this. But I can't change myself. Only God can. But if I don't put everything I got into it, it doesn't happen. The gift that I've been given, that every human being's been given, this free will, the gift of free will. Sometimes it might even be considered a curse. But I'll tell you what's happened to me in this 12-step experience is that gift that was given, this blessing of my own free will, I've given that back to God. That's truly what the third step is. And now my in my heart, I will obey. Words that used to stick in my craw, obey, I don't like that word. But now that word has a different meaning for me. That word is freedom. Everything that I thought was freedom was actually me putting shackles on myself. All those old ideas, old belief systems, all that had to be let go of. Today I will obey. God has a plan for me. And the beauty of this conscious connection, and it's intentional. Intentional conscious connection with God. I ask him to direct my thinking. And when I say him, her, you know, whatever works, it's just labels. The labels don't matter. What matters is the power behind the label. You know, I love the Taoist story of how we all get to the summit on a donkey. Your donkey may be a Christian donkey. Mine might be a Muslim donkey. You might be on a Judaism donkey, Taoist donkey. And all the whole time we're going up, we're commenting and making fun of each other's donkeys and criticizing and don't even see that we're on a donkey. And what does it matter? Because when we get to the summit, we all get off the donkeys. And we just enjoy being in the presence of God. I love that story, and I chopped it up, but that was a paraphrase. This life in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, A's got me. God's got me. A's given me everything. A, most of all, gave me freedom from the bondage of alcohol. But more than that, it gave me a path back to my Father's table. Of myself, I am nothing. The Father doeth the work. As Bill says in Bill's story, I believe that 100%. I know who I am as self. I'm driven by self-centered fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, and I'm constantly stepping on the toes of my fellows. Of self, I suffer of all those bedevilments on page 52. You know, with God's help and God's love and God's time, I'm at peace with myself, with you, with God. My life is full of joy, service, purpose, love, compassion, integrity, truth, justice. So much more than, you know, all the aspirations and all the coveting and clinging and clutching and grasping that I've done most of my life. I said earlier that I've suffered from a sense of lack my whole life. The only thing that ever removed that was King Alcohol and this relationship that I have with God. King Alcohol almost killed me. It literally destroys human tissue. It's a poison. God has never given me anything but peace and love and purpose. It's not hard to see which one is the better choice. So I've shared with you quite a bit. Hopefully I haven't offended too many. I realize always that I'm not for everybody. My message isn't for everybody. But I do want to tell you, please keep coming back. Give yourself a chance. In Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a way to, you do not have to drink today. That you don't have to chew on yourself and beat yourself up and live in fear and regret. And someday I'm going to have this and I should have. That you can have peace and joy and love in your heart. That's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that you find the same thing. That's all I have, Tara. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean. Really enjoy listening to you, your voice, your tempo, your message. It's a unique story, right? So you were around the rooms for a long time until you found the piece that you talk about today, which you were tricked into, in your own words. Do you think that they tricked you?
That's a good question. I think they just presented to me the truth, because it truly was my own conception. And what I think they were really telling me was, just have your own experience. Do these things in this 12-step process and have your own experience with God or higher power. And you just find your path. We'll guide you to the path and we'll be there with you along it. So trick, it seemed like it, but I think they were just being honest.
I had not heard the donkey thing before, but I've heard all paths lead to the same destination, and that resonates really well with me. I appreciate you sharing that. And it's true. The honesty is probably so shocking when we're new, right? Because we're so used to conniving and bullshitting and trickery to manage a life of using and abusing people, places, and things, that it looked like a trick, but really it was the solution. That it's experiential and you have to experience it yourself. If somebody gave us a higher power and told us the dogma that you speak of, like this is how it works, it wouldn't work. And that's the beauty of the program, is you are supposed to experience it uniquely, organically, yourself. Here are some steps to get you there. Go.
Yes, 100%. 100% in agreement. They lead you inward. We're always looking externally. And they just keep saying, no, look inside. It's the same thing in Christianity, when Jesus was asked, where's the kingdom of God? He said, look within. All the great religions say the same thing. All the mystics of, Christianity, Sufism, Hinduism, Buddhism, they all say the same thing. I say it in the way I say it. Nobody can love me enough. There isn't a pile of material possessions big and wide enough. There isn't a pill for what I got. I have found myself, and I have found a relationship with God within myself. It's not me. I am of that power. And it's just, as you said, experiential. Have your own experience. See what happens. We're so used to dogma, at least I was so used to dogma and this punishing, overwhelming, petulant, grandiose, childish version of God. And AA took me to something so much deeper, so much, has so much more substance, and is just really, truly pure love, you know.
That need to know you talked about in versus a leap of faith is what that really reminds me of. But this, it's, we need to know. I remember when I came to complete sobriety, I went on a journey to find out what was his name or her name and how does it work. And then through the steps, I realized I just wanted to know so that I can manipulate it to my best advantage.
Sounds about right.
But eventually I came to a place where I'm completely comfortable with remaining open-minded about the whole topic of a higher power, because that's how my relationship grows. If I put boundaries on it and rules and regulations and yeses and nos on how it works, then I'm going to limit my ability to get closer and to understand it more.
Well, you just described one of the most beautiful paradoxes and that I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous or mysticism is, you know, knowing through unknowing. The unknowing is knowing. And you don't know until you've experienced it. And then that being comfortable with unknowing. Oh, and I describe it as I'm okay with what is. You know, being in the flow. All of those descriptions are very much in line with what you were describing, the unknown, unknowing as a practice. And just being an observer, be the watcher, you know, watching my emotions, watching my thinking, watching my brothers and my sisters, watching nature and God's animals, his creatures. It is exciting. It is wild. It is scary. It's exhilarating. And I wouldn't want to live any other way. Conformity. Rituals are good. You know, having rituals, they teach me discipline. And I practice prayer and meditation ritually. We go to meetings ritually. But if that is all I have is the ritual, and I don't have the real experience that brings me to where it's more like a radical free cell, then I've missed the point.
You send text messages of a spiritual nature. Is that part of your ritual? I've been the recipient of a few of them.
Yeah, there's actually a story behind that. About 10 years ago now, a friend of mine who has been a what we call chronic relapsers in AA, and he was in another treatment center, and he had 30 days, and he sent me a text, asked me if I would share it with him daily, and I didn't really believe in it, but I wanted to be the good AA guy. You know, I've been sober a long time, and it's my friend, and he's struggling, so I'll go ahead and play along. He's going to fall off anyways. You know, he always does. So this won't last long. And he did. You know, he unfortunately got drunk again, and he's still out now. But I kept with it. Something happened to me. And those affirmations or expressions. And I started sending them to some people. It started building. It turned into like a community. And then even when I stop sending them to some people, I'll get like a message like, why aren't I getting your list? You know, I read a lot of spiritual literature and I listen to a lot of stuff, and you know, it kind of bleeds into my text messages sometimes. Yeah, it is part of to answer your question in a long way. It is part of my discipline. I do it daily.
Are those your words?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes. I have written most of my life. I've been an avid book reader since I was a child. That was my escape. You know, we didn't have 950 channels of television and video games and all that when I was growing up. I had books, and you know, my imagination. So writing has always been something that I've enjoyed.
Well, they're really poetic and well-written. I enjoy reading them.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
I am wondering if there's anything that you left out or anything that you're thinking of now that you'd like to share.
Yeah. You know, I think it's very important for new people and for just anybody that is, you know, suffering from, you know, alcoholism or suffering from a spiritual malady to have a fellowship of the spirit, you know, a home group, to have sponsorship or spiritual advisor, the 12-step process, that first three steps of getting to that, making a decision to turn my will and my life over to God, and then launching the course of vigorous action. In step 4 through 7, I come into conscious contact. Step 8 and 9, I set right the transgressions against my brothers and sisters. So I have conscious connection, I have accountability, I've healed, and I've forgiven. And then 10, 11, and 12, you hear them described as the maintenance steps, but it's not about maintaining, it's about evolving. And step 10 is really 4 through 9, all the spiritual tools that we've been taught. We've had this hands-on training on how to use these to develop our conscious connection with God and our brothers and our sisters. I use 11 interwoven with that to increase my conscious connection with God through prayer and meditation. And then step 12 is the practicing these principles in all my affairs. You know, we start learning at the AA meeting, washing cups, serving coffee, making coffee, having a literature commitment, and greeting the newcomers. And then we start learning how to take that to our homes, to our parents, our brothers, sisters, our wives, husbands, children, you know, then to the community, the job. So we're growing, we're not maintaining, we're evolving, and we're growing in this conscious connection with God and in service to my fellows, service to my Father, to my God. The 12 steps is a way of life. It's not a once through. It's not a graduation process. It's not linear. It's circular. You know, it is a way of life that allows me to live. You know, I could talk about God and love and service and community and fellowship all night. But I think that's enough. Hopefully conveyed the message.
You absolutely did. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. What it took for me to surrender to the spiritual principles. That was the only other thing that I usually say that I didn't say tonight is, see, I've lived most of my life by my thinking and my emotions. And now I'm anchored to spiritual principles and I trust and rely on my higher power. And that's really the difference, because I had physical sobriety through all of that, but I was dying of untreated alcoholism. See, there's still a part of me too, and that's why I know you're never cured. There's still this little bit, and it's really deflated, that thinks if you ever got an inexhaustible amount of money, because I never could acquire that, I tried, then I'd be happy. And that's still in there somewhere. It's very faint. And I know it's not real. And the only thing that keeps me away from that, being attached to that, and then that darkness growing to where I actually try to do it. And when I try to do something like that, legality and morals has nothing to do with anything. I'll do whatever the fuck it takes to get what I want. Is those spiritual principles and trust and relying on God. That keeps that darkness displaced by the brilliance of that inner light that we all have. This alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, as you know.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.